Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Ça c'est joie témoigno, ça c'est blague. Ogunno, what is ons? L'un sans petit à moi, joie à moi.
Thank you. Those paper dresses that I was putting up there are made in Haiti. They're patterns that the students of tailoring in Haiti learned to sew by making these patterns. In hardier times in Haiti, these patterns were very elaborate with crepe paper, lace, and all sorts of varied colors. Now they're just using plain butcher paper to make them, but they're very intricately detailed. You can't see them up close, but they've got pleats and bows and collars and things. They were made by Boss Yves, who is a refugee in a camp in Place Boyer. And his stand is right across the street from Quartier Latin, a very fancy restaurant in Pétionville. I'm going to read a story because that's what I have learned how to do from being an anthropologist in Haiti. And my story is called Unaccounted For. Forgot my glasses. Last February, just after the earthquake, I went to Haiti. I was supposed to be an international agency's person for violence, point person for violence against children in a country swallowed up by violent politics, violent health, violent weather, and now, as if the perfect symbolic framework for it all, tectonic violence. Every day I spent there was aggravating, shocking, devastating. My job, to make sure the children were safe, entailed moving things to the survivor camps. Every time I asked for tents, or nets, or lights, or anything, I was told supplies were low on the warehouse shelves, or they were empty, or in some way it was all impossible. A smooth, experienced technician would say, "Oh, you can order those from Amsterdam," which is one of the agency's production facilities. During the morning stand-up meeting, we'd get a pep talk and be reminded to keep moving the goods as fast as possible. They had raised more money in the first month after the earthquake than ever before in their history. During the day, my phone would ring constantly with reports of rapes. Little boys, little girls, and women. Tents slashed, girls gagged, mothers stabbed, food coupons traded for sex. On a visit to a child-friendly space, a group of parentless children clapped their hands, sang songs, and then unpacked their new toys from a shiny container. Outside, two small and threadbare 11-year-old boys, too old to join the session, leaned on the tent and toyed with knives. I was overwhelmed, and nothing was working. "Excuse me, ma'am. I understand, ma'am, you're the violence focal point." I kept pounding my computer keys, filling the order forms for Amsterdam. I had lost all sense of civility, especially to a man with a southern drawl. He was a bulky, middle-aged soldier, U.S. soldier, and looked upset. He asked about a child raped the night before. I knew instantly which child. "You mean the 2-year-old with gonorrhea in her mouth and her anus?" His eyes widened and he was choked for words. He became an easy target for my pent-up rage. He said he was worried, but before he could finish speaking, I snapped, "I'm worried too. In fact, I'm really fucking worried." He took a step backwards and said, but, "My ma'am, I'm only following up." I looked at him and I shouted, "Then follow up. She was raped by her neighbor. He slashed the tarp, gagged and tied up her pregnant mother, and then let loose in her tiny 2-year-old mouth and anus. Now they've got nowhere to go, no shelter, no nothing. So when you do your follow-up, why don't you look into some tents and some beds in a safe place, and maybe some security while you're at it, because that's what you do, right?" He continued to back up, raised his hand, silenced as if to say, okay, and he left. 30 minutes later, he returned. He asked me to go with him to the JOTC, the Joint Operations Training Center. There, a lot of young American men and women in fatigues introduced themselves, smiling and shaking my hand. They asked if I could accompany them to their base supply camp. The international agency told me I couldn't do things like that without their permission, so I immediately said yes, breaking a rule where not a single rule worked. We drove to a nearby camp with massive tents and pallets piled high with supplies. and my bulky soldier, trying hard to hold back his grin, said, "How about 500 beds from Guantanamo, 250 nets from Fort Bragg, and some drinking water? And if you come tomorrow, ma'am, we'll have more." I was stunned. In that moment, I had to reconfigure decades of mistrust of the U.S. military, especially as far as Haiti was concerned. Pointing, he said, "We have someone who wants to meet you." Another tall soldier approached, his shirt pocket heavy with stripes and medals, their general. He extended his hand, but I hugged him instead, giving him no time to retreat, which was also against the rules. He laughed nervously. To break the moment, he peppered me with questions. Where was I from? How was it that I spoke Creole? When did I arrive? How long would I stay? I explained how the international agency's warehouse was off limits and the Amsterdam issue. I detailed how the little girl was raped, ripped, and diseased. I thanked him and his soldiers again and again. When I paused only to take a breath, I couldn't really see his face except for a smile. I squinted in the sun looking up and told him I had something to say that I had never said in my entire life and that I needed to say it there and then. He paused as if to give me permission. "God bless America." He smiled again. "Well, ma'am, there are a lot of things we do that we're not proud of, but there is one thing that we do well, and that's logistics. We can move things, and we do it fast. I wish we were totally in charge here. It'd be a lot better. This place is a disaster." I told him I wanted to tell this story, but he gestured, indicating it was not a good idea. He looked at me and said, "You understand. Better not to talk. Just do. We'll call those beds and nets and water unaccounted for, lost in transit. I've got to go, ma'am. Keep up the good work." He winked at me and turned away. For nearly 2 months, those other smiling soldiers at the JOTC would send me a daily G-chat. "Good morning, Kati." And then detail the day's inventory of things unaccounted for, lost in transit. We delivered lots of things to lots of people. I colluded with the U.S. military. But I never found the little girl with gonorrhea again. She, too, was unaccounted for. Her story replaced by many, many others, far too many to count. And of course, those deliveries made by me in the U.S. military were far too few. The world has moved on to other news. The tragedies and the violence seem never ending in Haiti, a country also unaccounted for.
We think we're just going to move on to the next group, and we'll try and have a bit of time for questions towards the end. This is a function both of the fact that the presentations are so powerful on the one hand, and we're also running out of time. So the next group of three people will consist of Joe Mazingo, Maggie Staber, and Michael Daybert. Joe Mazingo works for the Los Angeles Times. He's a senior writer there and has covered Haiti and the Caribbean for several years for the Miami Herald. Maggie Staber is a documentary photographer. Her photos having appeared in magazines around the world, including Life, The New Yorker, Smithsonian, People, Newsweek, Time, and of all things, Sports Illustrated. She has received notable awards abundantly, including a World Press Foundation Award. Michael Daybert is a writer and journalist. His writing on the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia, where else, has appeared in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Miami Herald, the Guardian, and international outlets, like The Guardian and Le Monde, Diplomatique, World Policy Journal, and so on. He's been featured widely on radio and television, and his first book, Notes from the Last Testament, The Struggle for Haiti, appeared in November 2005. So Joe first.
Thank you. So I think today I'm going to talk a little bit about how the story of Haiti is told to most people in America and outside of Haiti through the much more mundane mainstream media. I've covered Haiti on and off for about 6 years. This last year I was down there right after, I was there January 13th, about noon, and had gone back about six or seven times. In my time in covering Haiti, I started to be bothered by a certain pattern of reporting there that I was noticing, and that I was part of it sometimes, and that most of us have been at sometimes. This notion that kind of reinforces the feeling that Haiti is a complete disaster, a complete dystopia, absolutely beyond repair. And I find this with everyone I talk to who know nothing about Haiti. They're surprised that there's anything there, that it's not just dust and pure ruin. You know, as I said, I've been guilty of this at some times, and it's sometimes unavoidable. Certainly after the earthquake, it was pure ruin. But I think in its totality, the foreign media paints a devastatingly distorted picture of Haiti. I know this for a fact, that the first impulse of most reporters who first go to Haiti is to find the most horrific, wretched thing they can find. You know, it's something with sewers or dumps or heads, you know, or bodies in the street or violence. I'm not talking during the earthquake. This is in calm times. People are usually looking for the squalor. One magazine last month had their big photo display of men walking through a dump. The main dump, there's one main dump in Port-au-Prince with smoke. It's a very eerie looking place, dust and smoke and piles of burning trash. And the way the photo was displayed, it was almost like, this is what Haiti is. You know, look at this. This is how bad it is. As if people were living in these, like, burrowed in the burning middens of trash at the dump. And I'm sure this photographer was trying to use this as a metaphor, but every photographer hits the dumps. And people who don't see Haiti won't see the metaphor. They're looking at that thinking, holy shit, this place is a complete nightmare. And I honestly think most reporters do this with earnest intentions. They do want to shock people. They see something really horrific to them, and they want the world to care about it. I think we mostly go down with this mission. But it's a really strange circumstance. I think Haiti is one of the few places where reporters will often just leave out of their hotels in the morning and just, with no itinerary, they're just troll around looking for bodies, you know, looking for someone carrying some horrifically big load on his back, someone doing some really gross job. And when things are calm, they kind of turn to a series of old standby stories, the Restaviks. Let's go to an orphanage, let's go to the prison, let's go to that horrible mental ward. Do you think they'll let us in the prison? Oh, we got to hit the mass graves. And then there's the pancake ladies, the ladies that make the clay pancakes so that we can show that Haitians eat mud. And so we go down there for just a political crisis or an earthquake, and suddenly we're analyzing every aspect of Haitian society as if we were, you know, anthropologists. And we're never historians looking back at why this happened. Anyway, all of this, as I said, creates this dystopia. And I think readers first say to themselves, how can these poor people live like that? But the more they read it, in their mind, they're slowly dehumanizing Haitians. I mean, real people can't live like that. Just two-dimensional people, people who eat dirt pancakes, who die in the street, who, you know, these are natural-born victims. And I don't think it's anything they ever actually consciously think, but I think in that this insidious process acts like that. Now, complicit in this whole cycle is the foreign NGO. It needs good publicity for the work it's doing there. Some are wonderful, Partners in Health, Doctors Without Borders. Many are middling. The middling NGO and the reporter conspire to... I need some water here. Whosever this was. The middling NGO and the reporter conspire to rip the lid off some sordid aspect of Haitian life and catch people's attention back home, knock them out of their Haiti fatigue, which they've helped induce, and, you know, up the ante. And in this partnership, the blonde, the white person, is always the savior. Haitians don't do anything for themselves, that they're too powerless, they're the victims, they have to be the victims. Now, the journalists who do the worst damage are the first-timers, who I call the me and Haiti, they do the me and Haiti stories, like a recent one in Esquire that I'm sure some people here are familiar with, and plenty of weeklies. And there's writers who tell you how they ride around in Haiti. They ride around in tap-taps. They sleep on the floor. How all the other reporters are driving around in SUVs and big fancy hotels. And they always tell you how dangerous it is. What they're doing is really adventurous and dangerous. So again, all of this together, you get back to America and people will ask you, you know, so what's it like down there? And you start to, if you start to tell them a little, yeah, I was eating a restaurant, you know, lunch over there, here, they're like, there's restaurants there? You know, there's car dealerships, there's banks, there's hotels, where do you get water? I mean, they literally had been picturing this post-apocalyptic wasteland. And as a journalist, I struggle with this because there is a truth to that other side. There are appalling conditions. The earthquake was an absolute horror, and the images are absolutely true. And the cholera epidemic is a horror. The camps are a horror. The slums that are always there are a horror. Ignoring or sanitizing these things would be against what every journalist works for. But we do need to create a fuller picture. I think the world's got the gist now. Haiti is a mess. It has its problems. We need to do a better job to explain how these problems became so entrenched and the cycles keep going over and over. And we need to be skeptical when an NGO when an NGO says they're doing this and that and this and that, when those things have been done for 50 years with nothing to show for them. Planting trees. I keep getting press releases. Hey, we're going to plant trees in Haiti. You want to come down and see our project? Well, you know, CARE started doing that in 1953, and I don't see any trees around. So anyway, final thoughts. We need to write about Haitian people in a much more textured, nuanced, three-dimensional ways. We need to really capture their personal struggles and how they, as all the photography, everything we've been talking about, they're the ones that survive. I mean, that the international community does help, but they know they're on their own more or less. And that struggle's incredibly powerful. And I think readers up here would be able to relate to them more as humans if that was the struggle that was portrayed. Anyway, that's the only way the rest of the world's going to care. So that's it. Thank you.
I guess that was my water. Good luck.
Talk later.
Maggie Staber.
I'm Maggie Staber. So I've been working in Haiti for more than 25 years. And I'm just going to show you very quickly a few earthquake pictures, which I was not going to do because the wonderful new generation of photographers, Damon Winter, whom I adore, showed you some great work that he's done. And there were many people trying to do great work during a very challenging moment. But it really is rather impossible to show the amount of damage. I was working as a colleague with Damon, happily for myself, and showing the extent of damage was really challenging. One thing that I did do was to do a series of photographs that then we stitched together that showed the whole one side of the whole one side of the street, the main street downtown in Port-au-Prince, the commercial street, and you can actually see that on the New York Times website. It's called Scenes from a Ruined Boulevard, and that was the only way I could figure out how to show. If you showed one street and how destroyed it was for blocks and blocks and blocks, maybe you would start to understand. But my real goal in Haiti, after the first few times I started going in 1986, I went in 1986 to photograph because I heard that there were food riots going on, and having been to Haiti before, I realized that that was really quite an extraordinary feat to see Haitians in the street fighting against the tyranny of the Duvalier regime. I'm going to backtrack for a minute. This earthquake is devastating to Haiti in many ways, but one of the things that became my real concern was and it's kind of perhaps, I don't know, inappropriate to say it after so many people were killed and so many people have been left homeless and things haven't moved forward. But one of the things that really worried me about the earthquake was the possible loss of culture. And I'm not talking about the culture of poverty, which is endemic and has plagued Haiti from the start, but the culture of voodoo and the culture of this sense of a very singular place in history, because this was, in Haiti, the only successful slave revolt in the history of the world. And it came at a time when the world economy really rotated on the backs of slaves. And so it was a remarkable feat against a very cruel master. It really colored everything after that. And so because the world was so upset by this great victory by slaves, they turned their back on the world, on Haiti, and they isolated Haiti. And because of that, as a result, Haiti really retained a lot of its African culture. And the more that you read about Haitian history and you read the literature and you look at the art and you really talk to people, the more you understand that there's such a rich cultural tradition on many, many levels and about many, many things. And my fear is that with the earthquake, that much of that will be lost. And of course, one of the things that happened during the earthquake was that many of the elderly people who are the repositories of culture, the ones who have the memory of so many years of history and the culture and what is important and that singular sense of pride of who you are as a Haitian would be lost. And in fact, I did a whole series of pictures on that because I was very concerned and still am about the loss of tradition. But I started going to Haiti in 1986 and I went because there was all of this rioting going on. And so I went straight up to Cape Haitien where a lot of that was happening, food riots every day. And one day at the end of a full day of rioting, everybody, all the people ran over to a food warehouse where they covered it like ants on a piece of candy. And the soldiers, the army arrived and they tried to beat people back. And they couldn't because it was so, people were so desperately hungry and starving. And finally the army, which sometimes was in its right mind, pulled back and let people take the food. And it was an extraordinary moment. This picture really doesn't express what was going on most of the time, but I'm not going to talk about every picture because, you know, they keep disappearing. And this is so Haitian. You know, every time I do a Haiti show, some little voodoo spirit gets involved and says, ha, 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 ha. Watch this, Maggie. Anyway, but I love this picture for several reasons, and one is that my photographic career changed dramatically after I took this picture, and it won some awards, and it brought me a lot of attention. But the real reason that I love this picture is because, for me, this is Haiti. It has Pepla, the people, starving and trying so hard to live. It has the cruel overseers, the dictators, the army, all of the people who are always there to hold them down. And then it happens to have this column in the middle. Now, this is why a photographer or a writer or anybody who's going to Haiti to do any kind of work should really learn the history of Haiti and learn about the culture and look at the art and read the literature, because for me that column is like a potomitain, and the potomitain is a pole in the middle of an unfort, a voodoo temple, and this is the only way the spirits can enter this world. And there's some little thing going on behind that column, and I will never know what it is, but I like to think it's a spirit. So for me, this is Haiti. So I was going to Haiti to cover news all the time, and finally I realized that I was participating in what I decided was a very unfair and unbalanced picture of Haiti. So I started to go when it was quiet, so that I could start to get a greater sense of the culture and who the people were, and that I could involve myself into a collaborative effort with Haitians, because I felt, after I learned so much about who they were and what they were really about, that they had to become participants in their own culture, participants in their own image, and that, as Joe just explained and other people have said and other people will say again today, that Haiti is always being portrayed in a certain way, and Haitians are often portrayed as victims, when in fact these are remarkable people who are very aware of their singular place in history.
Ça c'est joué timonio, ça c'est blague. Oguno, wa des anges, l'aime sans petit à moi, sois à moi.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.